Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hello, everyone. This is Chad Dotson. You're listening to Red Leg Nation Radio. This is episode number 138. With me is my friend and yours, Bill Lack. How are you today, Bill?
Well, at least yours. I don't know about anybody else.
You do have at least one friend.
I have one, but I pay him a lot of money.
Well, that's the way it works sometimes when you need a friend. You know, the Reds are still playing baseball, Bill.
Yeah, and some days it's a little better than others.
That's true. Right now, they're as we record this, 32-54. In last place, 20 and a half games behind, out of first place. That's probably about what we expected, but that's not good, is it?
I don't think we're going to catch them.
You think the Reds are out of the wild card race?
I think we've been eliminated.
Oh, come on, Bill. Have a little optimism here. And
yeah, you know what an optimistic guy I am.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's been a rough year, but there are always some interesting storylines around the Reds. This week, we had, just looking at the news of the week, Adam Duvall. Adam Duvall made his first All-Star team. He is also going to be participating in the Home Run Derby. And, you know, it's a continuation of what's been a really nice story. A guy that was sort of a throw-in on the Mike Leake trade last year and in his first full season as a starter in the big leagues. He's on the All-Star team.
Yeah, I'm real happy for the kid. You know, is he a great player? No, he's not going to be a great player. You know, he's 27 already, and he's really getting his first regular time in the big leagues. But, you know, he's having a good year. You know, and his numbers are pretty phenomenal considering how low his on-base percentage and how high his slugging percentage is. And I think he's got more extra base hits than regular hits or something like, you know, than singles.
Oh, yeah, quite a few more doubles, yeah. And I think he has one triple, and between doubles, home runs, and that triple, it's almost double.
Yeah, you know, but, you know, when you're spanking an on-base percentage of .289, your ceiling's pretty low. but you know what? Good for this kid. I mean, he got a chance to play, and this is what we talk about all the time. He got a chance to grab a hold of a job, and he grabbed a hold of it.
He did. I mean, at the beginning of the season, he was supposedly going to be in a platoon with Scott Schebler in left field, and he just grabbed it. He grabbed it from almost the very beginning.
He ran Schebler all the way to Louisville.
Yeah, and Schebler's hitting home run after home run in Louisville, but, you know, that spot's taken now in the big leagues. We got an all-star in left field. And you're right about the on-base percentage is low, and there are lots of reasons to think this guy's not going to be your starting left fielder for the next 7 years. As you might hope from a first-year All-Star. But I'm like you. I forget about that. It's a great story. You got to feel good for Adam Duvall, who's it must be living the dream right now. I mean, he really wasn't even sure he'd coming into spring training that he had a spot on the Major League roster. Right. And here we are in July, and he's got a spot on the All-Star team.
He's second in the league in home runs or third in the league in home runs?
Yeah. Yeah, and he's been tied for first within the last couple weeks. He's dropped to second, I think, now. But yeah, it's just it's an incredible story. And not even that, you know, he's going to be in the Home Run Derby, where in the semifinals he might face our old friend Todd Frazier.
Yeah, and before we hit the Home Run Derby, I also want to say something about his defense. You know, he's played a pretty good left field, considering he's never really played left field before.
It's really amazed me because the knock on him was that he was a butcher defensively. He could not stick in San Francisco with any regularity in the lineup because he was so bad at third base, which was where his previous position was. And so I expected nothing out of him as a left fielder. And you're absolutely right. He's been not just adequate, he's been actually good.
Pretty good, yeah. Here's that, and moving on to the home run derby, I'm not a big fan of it. And I don't think it's going to, especially somebody that's as young as he is and has had little major league experience, I'm not convinced it's not going to send him into a tailspin in the second half, as it did Todd last year. But whether, but who knows whether it's home run derby that does that or just the season getting long and your team being terrible. If he wants to do it and he gets a kick out of it, he may never get this opportunity again. You sure can't blame him.
That's sort of the way I look at it. And, of course, Frazier last year, there has been an argument that it did do something. But he was slumping going into the home run derby already. But with Duvall, you're right. When's he ever going to make another all-star team? He may make 5 all-star teams. I don't know. But I wouldn't be surprised if this were his only shot at it. And, what I'm concerned about is he's probably due to come back to ground level at some point anyway. It seems like he's playing a little above his head anyway compared to what his numbers have been in the past. And
yep.
Whether it's blamed on the home run derby or not, there's a chance that he's due to crash back to earth a little bit. I was looking, talking about Duvall and whether he's going to be a long-time all-star. I don't think either of us believe that's the case, but I was looking at which players had played fewer games in the big leagues, which Reds in the past had played fewer games in the big leagues when they made their first all-star game. And of position players, only 5 guys have played fewer games.
Is Chris Sabo one of them?
Chris Sabo is one of them. He only played 77 major league
games. That's what I kind of liken Duvall's career to. And I say the same thing about Frazier. They got to the big leagues late. They peaked real quick and were kind of gone before you knew it. And I think that's what's going to happen with this kid. Who are the other 4?
The one who played the fewest was Frank Robinson at age 20.
He was pretty good.
Yeah, he was not bad.
Yeah, he did all right.
Frank McCormick had played in 103 games. He was 27 at the time. And Johnny,
it was a different day then, though.
It was. Johnny Bench, age 20, had played 105 games. And Veda Pinson, age 20. So what you got are 3 all-time Reds legends, Frank Robinson, and Johnny Bench.
Yeah, both the last two were pretty – actually, all 4 of them guys were pretty good ball players.
Well, they're all – yeah, absolutely. I mean, fantastic players, but
if you take Sabo off that list, you're talking about some all-time Reds greats.
Well, Robinson, Bench, and Pinson are all just all-time baseball greats. Pinson, not quite Hall of Fame level, but close. And I agree with you about Sabo, actually. And I wrote a little piece for Cincinnati Magazine this week, and that's one of the things that I sort of I didn't really delve into it as much as I wanted to, but it's I alluded to the fact that of any of those, Sabo's clearly the better comparison. Any guy, and you brought up Frazier, which didn't even occur to me, actually, when I was writing that. That's a good point. A guy comes up that late, if you can get 3, 4, 5 good years out of him, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Sabo had made 3 All-Star teams in his first 4 years, but then he reached age 30, and it was downhill from there. So if we can get 3, 4 decent above-average seasons out of Adam Duvall, well, that's more than you would have expected for a guy who's a throw-in on a trade deadline deal.
I think if they, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, if they end up trading Jay Bruce, they're going to need a good year out of Duvall, even if they bring up Winker, because they're going to have to fill the other corner slot in the the outfield.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think he's got an opportunity to secure a place in the Reds lineup, and it's strange to be talking about somebody, an all-star, securing a place in the Reds lineup for the next year or two. But that's really where we are, and I can't imagine what else he could have done other than maybe take a walk or two.
Before you get off of this, though, I just pulled Frank McCormick up, and he made 8 all-star teams, won the MVP once, and was in the top 10 for the MVP voting 3 other times, so he wasn't a bad player either.
Oh, no, absolutely. All 5 of the guys ahead of Duvall on that list that I gave you, all 5 of them are in the Reds Hall of Fame. And the guy right after Duvall on the list is Adam Dunn. I never pass up an opportunity to talk about Adam Dunn. You know that.
We love the Dunner, man.
We do. We love the big donkey. But he was 22 when he made his first All-Star team. He had played in 151 games. And he'll be in the Reds Hall of Fame when he's eligible as well. So
over Marty's dead body.
Well, Marty doesn't get a vote, does he? Surely.
I think Marty gets a veto on everything to do with the Reds organization, but anyway.
Yeah, Marty gets a
moving on.
Hall of Fame line item veto.
But we're good. We're happy for Adam Duvall and wish him continued success.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I've said it 15 times, and the best way I can describe it is it's just a fun story. Next up has been in the news a little bit this week, as people are starting to talk about it a little bit, is the question, and this was your idea to talk about this on the podcast today, it's the question of Brandon Phillips, of whether what should the Reds do with him? And at Red League Nation Day, actually, Nick Carrington wrote a piece about it. You should go read it at redleaguenation.com. But I think you and I are, we've had a little bit of a difference of opinion on Brandon Phillips over the years. I've softened on him a little bit. I have a feeling our what we're going to say about Phillips and what the Reds should do with him is going to probably be pretty similar.
Well, I've been saying that. I said this at the beginning of the season, that if they get to a point where they think Peraza is ready, then they're going to have some really difficult decisions to make. And especially now that Phillips is really, you know, is struggling. I mean, he's having his worst offensive year in a number of years. History tells you with second basemen that their careers kind of fall off the cliff at some point over the age of like 32, I think it is. And, you know, his OPS plus right now is 75.
Yeah, 35-year-old middle infielders aren't usually the guys you want to depend on.
Well, and he's not playing the defense that we're used to seeing from Brandon Phillips either.
There's your difference. You're starting to notice he's still okay. But he's missing plays or not making plays that we've gotten so accustomed to him making over the years. It's really just it makes my jaw drop sometimes.
Well, and the number of errors that he has is pretty amazing considering how shorthanded he's always been.
And the defensive metrics, you and I, we've talked about this 100 times, and who knows how much to make of that. But it does sort of equate to what we're seeing with our eyes. His defensive metrics are way down. But, you know, it's still slightly above average, but he's just not he's not the guy we came to expect. And if he's not going to hit, we need him to play that elite defense like he used to. He last year had a good season.
You know, yes.
Sort of a resurgent season. Yep. And it was
Absolutely. Good
to see because he'd been in a decline. But if you take last season out, you look at 2012, 2013, 2014, 2016, it's a drop off the cliff. All across the board, all his numbers are just, it declines every year. From a 750 OPS down to 706, to 678, to 650 this year. His WAR, wins above replacement totals, 3.4 back in 2012, down to 2.5, then 1.6, and this year it's negative 0.5. He's below replacement level at second base for the Reds. So the question, the options are.
I bet he's still the last guy on the field every game.
you never miss an opportunity to point that out, and it is. It's a fact.
It's one of my things.
Yeah, I know. I don't blame you, but and he's also. I think we're going to talk about Brian Price in a moment, but he's also been batting third for much of this season as a below replacement level player. So your options are these: number one, if you can convince somebody to take him.
Yeah, good luck with that.
At this point, convince him to accept the deal. The Reds obviously had two trades worked out for him in the offseason. He declined both because he has no trade rights, being what they call a 10-5 guy. He's been in big leagues for 10 years and with the same team for 5. And, good luck with that. One way that might be amenable to him is if you tell him, if you don't accept it, then you're going to the bench and we're going to start Peraza every day. I think that's what should happen anyway. I hate to see this whole he's a Reds Hall of Famer. He's going to be.
Yep.
I hate to see the relationship sour at the end, but it makes no sense not to be getting Peraza.
Well, and I think we previewed this exact problem before the season when we talked about this. And the concern is the damage that Phillips could do to this clubhouse if he's a dissatisfied player on the bench. He's not the most mature gentleman in the world, as we can attest through, you know, Twitter and tirades and everything else. But I think the Reds need to, they should try to do whatever they can do to avoid eating $20 million, which is what they still owe this guy.
I think they're going to have to eat that no matter what. Even if they can find somebody to take him, I imagine they're going to have to pay a substantial amount of that.
Yeah, they're going to eat a bunch of it. Yeah. But who would want him? I mean,
that's the problem. They had a contender. The Washington Nationals wanted him before the season, and he could be. They're lucky that they didn't get him because they got Murphy at second base now. He's playing great, but yeah, he could have been playing for a contender right now and playing for his old buddy Dusty, and now he's crazy. It's kind of the reverse Jay Bruce. You know, Jay Bruce's trade value was low, and he's rebuilt it over the last 3 months. And Brandon Phillips's trade value, I imagine, we don't have any inside information, but I imagine it has to have cratered over the last 3 months.
And it probably wasn't that high to begin with.
Probably not. So you trade him for what you can get. Really, your three options are trade him if you can, and we've talked about why that may not be the case. You may not be able to. Put him on the bench, let Peraza play. You got to talk Brandon into not blowing the whole thing up in the clubhouse if you do that. Although, if he does blow it in the clubhouse, well, you know, what
then do you... Then you have to go to option three, which is you just cut him loose.
Just get rid of him. I mean, if you're going to have to pay that $20 million or whatever anyway, it's a sunk cost.
Yep, you can't let it damage the future of the ball club.
Right.
You know, the damage you can do to young players and you know, psyches and all that stuff, you know. So, but we've already talked about Brandon Phillips longer than we should.
I agree. Let's go into one more quick thing before we move on to our next segment. And that's the fate of Brian Price and his coaching staff. What do you think is going to
happen? Well, I was surprised at the move last weekend when they fired the pitching coach.
I was too, Mark Riggins. Yeah,
I mean, I'm not going to say that the pitching staff hasn't been a disappointment. Yes, it has, but it isn't all Riggins' fault. The front office, and actually, if you read everybody's quote from Jocketty to Price to everybody else, they were all very careful not to lay this at his feet.
That's true.
But nevertheless, the guy's out of a job.
Right.
Now he's still with the organization if he chooses to be. The good thing that came out of that was Ted Powers finally getting coaching in the big leagues after, I think, 17 or 18 years in Louisville.
Yeah.
But I think it serves no purpose to fire this coaching staff before the end of the year. I don't even think so. If you fire Price, what kind of – I mean, I guess you could be sending a message, but I don't really know what the message would be.
I don't understand what the point of it would be. Let me talk about Ted Power for a moment, though, by the way. I'm not happy about Ted Power being in Cincinnati because I actually was going to interview him for something I'm putting together and had it set up with Louisville, and then now he's gone from Louisville, so I've got to start over again with the Reds. But
you're happy for Ted.
I'm very happy for Ted. You know, everybody in Louisville has had nothing but good things to say about him. He gave us some time for the podcast last week, actually, and he's, by all reports, he's always wanted to get back to the major leagues, but he's not complained. He's done his job in AAA, and really happy for him getting a chance.
Good organization guy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, he was a good pitcher for the Reds.
Even though he started against the Reds, I think, in the fifth game of the clinching game of the 90 series.
Game six of the 1990 National League Championship Series. Yep. Yeah.
I was there.
He was just, oh, excellent. Big game. A nice win for the Reds.
Glenn Bragg's reaching over the fence.
Oh, with one out in the ninth, robbing Carmelo Martinez. We're getting old, Bill.
Oh, we're going to get older here in a minute, but go ahead.
That's true. But going back to Price, what's the point in firing him? You're going to pay two managers then if you do that, which doesn't make any sense when you're trying to save money. You are bringing somebody in who... I don't know how anybody else could do any better with this team. Maybe somebody could do better. Sparky Anderson probably would have done better with this team. Sparky Anderson would not have made this a playoff team.
You could have put Sparky Anderson, Casey Stengel, and John McGraw in one person, and they couldn't turn this into a playoff team.
Right. So, you know, Price, that's no doubt about it. And not that we're saying that Price is a mixture of those three, but he's in hamstrung from day one. They gutted the roster on him. He's really never had a chance. I think he's probably released after the year, and they'll have somebody coming in next year. I don't know who, but
I don't know who would want to take over this team after they're going to lose 100 games. You know, there's a lot of, you know, you hear the local talk about Barry Larkin. Why in the world would Barry Larkin want to take this team over?
Zero chance of that is my prediction. Zero chance.
I think they bring up the Shields for a couple of years and let him, they hang 100 losses on him, you know, next year, and hopefully, you know, 80 the year after. and then they fire him, and then maybe you get somebody when the team's headed in the right direction.
And that's when you'll get a guy that you really think can be the manager for the next good Reds team. If they're on, you know, they've said a few times, we think 2018 was when we can be competitive again anyway. If they really believe that, my suggestion would be keep Brian Price around next year. Because if you're just going to lose, unless you think he's actively harming your young guys, your young pitchers especially, he's doing something that's helping them not to develop. He's getting in the way of progress. But yeah, if not, let him take the losses.
The only problem with that is you got to sell tickets.
Well, that's true, but I mean, is Delino DeShields going to sell tickets? Maybe getting rid of Price, just doing that.
I think that's the selling point. Is, you know, well, we're making a change.
I hate it because I actually think Price has been not terrible as a manager.
He's been worse than I thought he'd be.
But he's also done some things that I wouldn't never have seen from any previous Reds manager. You know, hitting Votto second, hitting Billy Hamilton ninth when he was struggling. I mean, thinking outside the box a little bit. You know, he does the same dumb stuff as well that we see, and his usage of the bullpen is questionable. Not that he has a bullpen this year, but
not this year.
I don't know. I think he's probably gone, and I think that the reason that you stated ticket sales might be as good a reason as any, because there's a big contingent. We get it at people tweet at Red League Nation every single day. Fire Price. And
they had a huge drop off in season ticket sales from last year to this year because of the All-Star game.
Right, yeah.
And it'll drop even more. If you're looking for good season tickets, my guess is you'll have a pretty good selection after this season.
Yeah, lots of good seats available. Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to our next segment, Bill, which is the question of the week. And this week's question of the week, I say this week's is the first time we've used this segment, but it's going to be a recurring feature. Jay Bruce and Zach Cozart, there's lots of talk about whether they're going to be traded at the trade deadline at the end of this month. Are Jay Bruce and Jack Cozart future members of the Reds Hall of Fame? You want to take a stab at that, or you want me to take the first
one? Did you say Jack Cozart or Zach Cozart? Because I didn't know if he had a brother.
I hope I said Zach. Because Jack Cozart's not getting anywhere near the Reds Hall of Fame.
Because I say one yes and one no. I think Bruce is a no-doubter. I think Zach Cozart is, and he's in my wife's Hall of Fame because she loves him because she thinks he's the most gorgeous man and she's ever seen in a Reds uniform.
I can't argue with that.
But he's just another short. You know, he's just another player. He's nothing else. You know, there's nothing about him to put him in the Reds Hall of Fame. Now that's not to say that we don't have players in the Reds Hall of Fame that were just average players. I think Tommy Helms is in the Reds Hall of Fame. Yeah. I'm not positive of that, but I believe so.
Oh, I think he is, yeah.
And Tommy Helms was no great shakes either, even though he won a Rookie of the Year.
And a guy like Ron Oster, who, you know, Cincinnati guy.
He's a Cincinnati kid, and that sure gives you a leg up.
It does. I think you're right about Cozart, except I will add this. I wouldn't vote for him for the Reds Hall of Fame, for whatever that's worth. And what it takes to get in the Reds Hall of Fame is sort of nebulous, because
yeah. –
Like you said, there are people that probably shouldn't be in, and guys like who I think should definitely be in, like Reggie Sanders, who aren't in.
Freddie Norman,
yeah, absolutely.
And that could be one of our segments sometime, is which Reds that aren't in the Hot Reds Hall of Fame should be.
All right, hold on, let me make that note. but about Cozart, I don't think he's a Reds Hall of Famer. He's had he's been in Cincinnati. This is his fifth year as the starting shortstop, which is impressive. Any guy sticking around as a starting shortstop for any team for 5 years is impressive. I think he has been seriously underrated and undervalued as a Red, just because his defense since day one has been as good as any other shortstop in the league, in my opinion.
Well, the other thing is, you're coming into Cincinnati to play shortstop. You're following in three pretty big sets of shoes.
Oh, unbelievable! Absolutely, and it's hard to live up. It's hard to live up to the ones that came before, especially Barry Larkin and Davey Concepcion.
And even before them, Leo Cardenas was a pretty good player.
Absolutely, yeah. So the Reds have a long history of good shortstops, and Cozart's been a good shortstop. He's been a valuable player for this team since he got here. you know.
I think his defense has been valuable. I think his offense has been decent the last year.
Yeah, and oftentimes awful, yeah.
Yeah, and oftentimes awful,
But you know, he's been between a 2 and 3 win player by WAR every year, thanks basically to his defense mostly, but
yeah.
And that's bumped up now that he's been hitting. So, but, you know, it's a
maybe he's one of those few guys that's learned how to hit at the big league level, and if so, you know, when they trade him, he can still have a number of good years. I'm not sure exactly how old he is right now.
He's 30.
He's 30, so he's got, you know, shortstop. He's probably got maybe 3 years left, maybe 4.
Oh, he could be he could really help a contender that might want to trade for him at the deadline. I think he should be the number one shortstop that's available out there, and he's having a fantastic season. I've got zero complaints about his season.
Yep.
I'm a big fan, huge fan of Zach Cozart, and have been one for a while because of the glove, and now that he's hitting, I hate to see him go, but I'm not going to offer a contract extension to a 30-year-old shortstop.
You just can't.
Not where the Reds are now. If the Reds were going to be competing for a pennant next year, I might think about it because he's steady.
Well, you're hearing, and there's some people. Steve wrote a really nice article on the website about Jay Bruce, and there are people on there that saying they should extend Jay, and I just can't see it. And it kills me because I'm a big Jay Bruce fan for all the reasons that Steve talked about in the article. It's both for what he's done on the field and the way he holds himself off the field.
Great representative of the organization.
Just yeah.
Unbelievable.
You know, and nobody, when he struggles, you know, nobody struggles with him more than I do. But by the time they're going to be contenders again, you're going to have you'd be too heavily invested in Jay, and between Jay and Votto, for the money you'd have to spend, I think we can spend the money better elsewhere.
Well, I'm on the other side of that argument, which I'll discuss in a moment. But I want to agree with you first that, yes, I think Jay Bruce is a no doubt, absolute slam dunk Reds Hall of Famer.
First ballot, whenever they decide he's, you know, going to be on the ballot, I think he'll.
Yeah, he's seventh in team history in home runs. He's top 15 in team histories in doubles and RBIs. He has more home runs than any player ever at Great American Ballpark. Joey Votto is liable to pass him up on all those lists, but Jay Bruce is he's a Reds legend. I mean, I think you can say it. He's going to be a Reds Hall of Famer. And I think that qualifies you to be he's not a baseball legend, maybe, but he's been a very good player.
As Steve said in his writing, the problem is he's never reached the levels that he was expected to reach because of how well he played in the minor leagues.
And that's so unfair to him to judge him on that because, you know, playing Major League Baseball is hard, and he's been an above-average player, and are we really going to, you know, hammer him for not being better than he is? I mean, it's just he is what he is, but... I'm one of the guys who, and I will admit right up front that I would be a terrible general manager because I'm too much. I let my heart get in the way of my head a little bit too much. But I'm talking myself into the Reds, seeing if they can sign Jay for 4 years. If he'll agree to some contract for 4 years.
How much would you? What would you be looking at? You know?
I don't know. It's not my money. you know.
You just hand him a check and let him fill it in.
I'd let him fill it out. Because I think I can see a scenario where the Reds really could compete here in a couple years. I really can see that. And Jay Bruce is just 29 years old.
And to go against my own argument here, it's not like there's bats backed up to AA in this organization.
Exactly. That's absolutely what where I was going with this. We don't have any really ready-made solutions. Now, I guess if you think Jesse Winker is going to be ready soon, and he's been injured a little bit, but he's ready. And if you think Adam Duvall is a long-term answer, well, there's a couple of corner outfielders.
But
yeah, that's a big but.
I mean, I still think you got quite, you know, and you and I disagreed about this. We were talking about it on social media. You know, you're Billy Hamilton's starting to win you over.
Oh, I love me some Billy.
Yeah.
You gotta love Billy. Come on, man.
Oh gosh.
He was named after you.
I've got a javelin that weighs more than Billy Hamilton.
It's not as fast.
It is when you throw it.
Maybe.
Anyway, I don't want to get off on Billy Hamilton, but what I'm saying is if you trade Bruce, you got questions all over in the outfield. Because as much as you love your Billy, you're not going to tell me that he's a sure thing in center field.
I'm not ready to offer Billy Hamilton a long-term contract.
Okay.
No.
So you know, I understand your point, but it would also depend on what I'd be dangling Bruce and Cozart, and I'd be trying to get outfield bats. That's what I'd be looking for.
Yeah.
So you don't know what they might bring, and it might be a guy playing in AAA. Which isn't a sure thing, God knows.
It's not, but I agree. I think that the way it makes sense, well, there are two ways it makes sense. Number one, if Bruce is just going to cost more than you really is, you know, whatever he's going to cost, is it enough to where in 3 years he and Votto are commanding so much that this just really doesn't make sense? Then I think, you know, financially you probably have to, if you think you can't sign him for something reasonable, and I'm not talking about asking Jay to take some kind of a hometown discount or something. Jay's, you know, he'll get what he has every right to ask for whatever he thinks he's worth. But I think if you look 3 years down the road and you think, they're taking up 40% of the budget, that's probably not.
And Votto's salary is going to be, you know, unless the budget can, you know, rise as much, it's going to be a healthy percentage of it just on his own.
Right. So then you're talking about tying up two guys for a lot of it. In that sense, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to.
Here you are with your heart in your hand again.
I know. But if I can't, he's on the trade market and we think he's rebuilt his value, and maybe he has. We don't know what the market is for him. If you can get a young outfield hitter, somebody that you think can be a guy that could possibly be in your outfield for the next 5, 6, 7 years. Well, yeah, I mean, do it.
And the flip side of what you were just talking about is, you know, now that he's rebuilt his trade value, his price tag goes up.
Yeah, absolutely. he might be able to command more in trade, and that would sort of lean towards the idea that they should trade him. Another part of why he could be valuable in the trade market is he actually has another full year on his contract.
Right.
So
he's got an option year, I believe.
Yeah, so whatever team trades for him gets a year and a half of him.
The thing that I can't figure out is why his defense has dropped off so badly.
I don't think it has. I think it has dropped off.
Well, I'm just going by your defensive metrics.
I know we've had that argument.
You know, I'm not a big fan, and that's what I was going to say because I don't see it to the eyeball test.
I saw a couple of scouts today. FanGraphs actually had a piece just today on Jay Bruce's defense and how the eye test doesn't match what these defensive metrics are saying. And I think the conclusion was sort of yes. Since his that knee injury in 2014, his defense has declined. But it's, number one, it's not nearly as bad as what the metrics say it is. Number two, it's mostly just because he really evidently struggles going back on balls. That's almost entirely where the defensive metrics are hammering him. Everything else, he's still a decent average outfielder at least. And I think that having Billy Hamilton beside him makes those numbers look worse as well, because Hamilton can cover like 6-7 miles in the outfield.
What is this? He's out there on a golf cart.
I'm telling you. Listen, I'm going to get you on the Billy Hamilton bandwagon before it's over, Bill.
Yeah, you said that about Brandon Phillips, too.
Yeah, well, that was a little bit more difficult than anyone would have imagined. But, you know,
I'm not anti-Billy. I'm just not he's going to have to hit a lot better to win me over.
Sure, you're not a believer yet. I think that's reasonable. I think that's completely reasonable. The other part about his trade value is if the teams believe that those defensive metrics are correct, what does that do to his value? I guess it only takes one trade partner to think that Bruce is a valuable player. But, you know, there's so many variables here. I think you explore every option. I think everybody's just assuming that he needs to be traded. I personally don't believe that's the case. But I think there are really good arguments on both sides of it, and the Reds need to do what's going to provide the most value for this team over the next, you know, 4 years.
Yep.
Whatever that is. And I don't know the answer right now.
And the other thing is, we don't really know who's making those decisions right now, I don't think.
Things are sort of in flux in the Reds front office.
The media and they're starting to talk to Williams more, but you're still seeing Jocketty's name pop up. So, you know, whether they're working together, whether one's working for the other, who knows?
Yeah, and I really wonder, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in the Reds front office during this offseason and going into next season, as Dick Williams is the official, well, he's the official general manager now, but he'll officially be taking over all the duties after this season. But, you know, Jocketty's still in the room. Jockey's still going to be there as team president, and I just wonder what that dynamic's going to be like, whether Williams has a little bit more free reign or if he's still – I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I think there are reasons to hope that Williams will be a good general manager.
And if push comes to shove, who does Castellini back?
Right, yeah, and I would be surprised if it were anyone other than your buddy, Walt Jockety.
And the only thing I will say about Williams, and I may have said this in the past on here, is that when I talked to Chris Welch about – he was really happy about this guy getting this job. He really thought he was an up-and-coming GM.
Yeah, I think that I've had a little bit of correspondence with him, been very pleased with what I've heard. I don't know Dick Williams. I can't say that, but have had a chance to meet him and talk with him briefly. I don't know what to think. Of course, Chris Welch's opinion means a lot to me, as I know it does to you. It always has.
Yep.
He sort of tells it like it is and is – makes a pretty good call on these things usually. So that goes a long way with me. But who knows? Is he going to have free reign, number one? Number two, I don't know. How much is he into the analytics? He's open-minded, it seems like. Until there's evidence to show me otherwise, I choose to be optimistic about Dick Williams. Mostly because, you know, he and I were students at the University of Virginia at the same time. Did you know that, Bill?
No, I didn't, and you know, boy, that really wins me over.
our time there overlapped by I think 1 year. He's a little older than me, but yeah, we're both of us University of Virginia Cavaliers. So clearly, this guy's smart. I mean, we know that if he's a UVA guy,
of course he is. The only thing would have been better if he'd gone to Georgetown.
Oh gosh, man, let's not get crazy here. So the question of the week was, are Jay Bruce and Zach Cozart future members of the Reds Hall of Fame? I think we agreed one vote or two votes for yes for Jay Bruce.
And two votes for probably not for Zach Cozart. Other than my wife's Hall of Fame.
In the sexy red Hall of Fame, I guess Zach Cozart makes it?
He's a first ballot winner.
First ballot inner circle Reds Hall of Famer. All right, let's move on to our final segment of the podcast. And the last time you and I were here, before you decided to take vacations and all that stuff you like to do.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, I guess so. How's Key West this time of year?
Hot.
As always.
It was hot. It was, if it wasn't the hottest it's ever been when we were down there, it was the second hottest it's ever been for most of the week. But then on Sunday, the weather broke and it was beautiful, which happened to be the day we went out on the water. So it was really nice.
Nice, nice. Well, the last time you were here, we talked about instituting a new segment called, we've decided to call it Team Retrospective. And what we talked about was, let's pick a team from Reds history and just talk about them. Try to remember them a little bit. Now, I can't remember this team since they were before I was born. But I'm sorry, I had to throw that in, Bill.
Yeah, you did.
But today we're going to talk about the 1970 Cincinnati Reds. And, of course, the 1970 Reds led by Sparky Anderson.
His first year?
First season as manager of the Reds, and led them to a 102-60 record, 102 wins. National League Championship, beat the Pirates.
And they won 70 of their first 100 games.
Wow. That's not a bad start to a managerial career, is it?
They were 72-34 at the end of July, just for a comparison.
And this Reds team is going to be 32-74 at the end of July.
No, if the Cubs wanted to equal that by the end of July, they'd have to go 20. When I looked the other day, they'd have to go 20-3 in July.
Wow. And that says something, especially when you consider that that team, as good as it was, did not win the World Series. They swept the National League Championship Series 3-0 over the Pirates, and then lost in five games in that memorable World Series to the Baltimore Orioles, the Brooks Robinson series, I always think of it as.
Yep. Couple other things before we get too deep into this. So Sparky was only 36 when he took over the Big Red Machine. Now, he looked a lot older.
Yeah, he always looked older.
But he was only 36 when he took over the Reds. And I think when you start talking about the 70 Reds, you really have to go back to 69. Dave Bristol had been the manager. The Reds had come in third in the 69, four games out, in a great pennant race. Which is chronicled in our favorite book, Ball 4.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
After the season, Bob Housel made a trade. They traded Alex Johnson, who had been the Reds' starting left fielder.
And had a pretty good year in 69.
Yeah, a good hitter, terrible outfielder. Mm-hmm. traded him to the Angels for a guy named Jim McLaughlin. It was a big wheel, a big spoke in the wheel of the 70 team, and a guy named Pedro Bourbon, who had a few pretty good years for the Reds.
Yeah, one or two, absolutely.
The other thing you got to remember at the 70 teams, that was the year that we transferred from Crosley Field to Riverfront Stadium in the middle of the season.
Yeah, start of the year at Crosley Field, and I think after the All-Star break, or maybe it was the beginning of...
End of June. 30th, I think, was the first game at Riverfront, something like that. They played 700 baseball at home that year.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. They played 500 better against everybody in the National League that year except the Cubs and the Padres. Their longest losing streak on the season was 4 games.
Golly. That's an average week for this current Reds.
Yeah. The things you got to remember, but there were some interesting things about this team, though. It was the end of Jim Maloney's career, basically. He blew his Achilles tendon out early in the season. You wonder how, you know, he was only 30 years old. You wonder how good, if he hadn't done that. I mean, in 69, he still put up a 2.77 ERA.
We talk about some of the, like Eric Davis, what might have been. To me, right. Jim Maloney's a big time what might have been. What if he'd been healthy on that big red machine for the next few years?
Even if he probably couldn't have got to 75 and 76, but he could have got him through to 73 maybe.
Sure, and he would have helped those teams in 70, 72, 73.
And the biggest what if on this team is a guy named Wayne Simpson.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
He went. His career was so he had a career in 70 of his ERA plus was 1.39.
Wow.
He was 14-3 with a 3.02 ERA, and it was basically he was done by the end of July.
Yeah.
He threw 176 innings by the end of July.
14-3. Struck out 119 batters.
And he walked, and that's the other problem. He walked a lot of guys. He had 81 walks. I mean, he averaged 4 walks a game. But if you look at his game log, I think he threw a 2-hit shutout on his first start in the big leagues, which always reminded me of Johnny Cueto, who I think did something along the same lines. But the pitching staff on that 70 team, as much as it was beat up, and by the end of the season, by the time the playoffs rolled around, they were pretty beat up. I remember that because this was my first favorite Reds team. I was 12, and I got hooked on baseball in 69 because of ball four, which came out in 70. But I remember that pennant race in 69 really well. But this 70 team was really my first favorite Reds team. But the pitching staff led the National League in wins and saves, was second in ERA, and shutouts, and hits, and earned runs. And third in the league in home runs. The average age of the pitching staff in 1970 was 25.
And probably their worst starting pitcher won 20 games.
Yeah, it was the guy that won 20 games.
Right. Jim Merritt went 20-12.
Yep.
4.08 ERA.
And I think he was the only left-hander, if I remember right, in the rotation.
Well, you had Simpson at 21 and Gary Nolan, another what might have been, at 22 years old that year.
I always think that about Nolan, and he missed at least he missed one full year, I think, in 74 and parts of other years. But he still had a pretty daggone career. And you talk about a guy that reinvented himself as a pitcher. He went from a guy that was striking out 200 guys a year to a guy that was striking out 70 guys a year or something along those lines. I mean, he became a soft tosser on the big red machine.
And was successful doing that, but his career was over at 29. I mean, never saw the heights that we expected at ages 19, 20, 21, 22. But,
but this team also had a great bullpen. I mean, they had 3 guys in the bullpen whose ERA plus is the lowest one was 1.58.
Wow.
Wayne Granger was 1.58. Clay Carroll was 1.62, and a very young 19-year-old Donnie Gullett had a 1.72 ERA plus
at 19. That's fantastic. And of course,
Sparky really he only started 2 games that year, but he had a foreshadowing of greatness. He's another what could have been.
Oh, no question. No question.
You know, but you look, and then, you know, in this team, the offense, I mean, they just came in and beat you to death. And that was with two almost automatic outs in the lineup. When Tommy Helms and they played kind of a three-headed monster at shortstop that year. Concepcion ended up getting most of the playing time by late in the year, but early in the year, Chaney got some playing time, and Woodward got some. But, you know, Tommy Helms wasn't a very good player that year. You look at the bench won the MVP. Perez had as good a year as Bench did offensively. Almost. I mean, you know, it's nip and tuck.
It was Bench's first MVP, just to note, and he was 22 years old.
Yeah. You know, Pete had a good year.
Pete Rose.
Number 14, nobody wants to wear that.
Right, yeah, that guy.
Unless maybe as he said the other day at the ballpark, that if his grandson makes the big leagues, he wants his grandson to be able to wear number 14.
Well, that'd be just fine. That'd be fine.
But, you know, Bobby Tolan had a heck of a year for him. And Carbo was second in the league in Rookie of the Year voting. I mean, he had a 1.04 OPS.
And Carbo, 22 years old, goes back to what you were saying about Alex Johnson. When he was traded, Carbo slid right into that spot in left field and was just a revelation at age 22. 3.10 average.
They platooned left field that year. Carbo played, and Hal McRae was the other side of that platoon, who was a pretty fair country hitter himself in the big leagues.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. But you had Carbo at 22 who got played 125 games, and you're right.
McRae played 70 games, and he was only 24.
Yeah. But you were starting to see some of these guys filter through. Obviously, Rose and Tommy Helms and Tony Perez were guys that came up through the Reds. But, you know, Bernie Carbo in the 65 draft, Bernie Carbo was the first-round pick and Johnny Bench the number two pick. And at age 22, these guys are not just starting, but really stars in the big league at that point. Carbo never reached the heights, obviously, of Bench, but he was good that year. And so you're really starting to see the seeds of the Big Red Machine.
Absolutely. Even the bench was, you know, McRae, when he wasn't starting, Jimmy Stewart was a good bench player. Ty Cline was on this team that year, and he had a really good year off the bench for the Reds, and was maybe the most controversial World Series play for the Reds, other than the Ed Armbruster play in 75, in game one of the World Series. Carbo on third, Cline hit a chopper. Hendricks has the ball. He tags Carbo with the glove, and the ball's in his hand.
Right, right.
You know, Sparky. And that's one of the things. If you've never seen the tape of Sparky Anderson arguing with the umpire after that play, Sparky never said a cuss word. He didn't say one cuss word as he's arguing with his ump. In the World Series, game one, I mean – if you can't love Sparky Anderson for that, you know.
Oh, Sparky. We love Sparky for many reasons. You mentioned Jimmy Stewart a second ago, not to really shift too far away, but Jimmy Stewart, played 101 games, but only had 116 plate appearances that year as a sort of a utility guy off the bench and had a good year.
He was mostly a pinch hitter. I bet you, and I don't know if you can look that up, I bet he didn't play a whole lot of defense.
No, I'm sure of it. But a good story is 30 years later, Jimmy Stewart was an advanced scout in the Reds organization. And the story goes that at the time, our buddy Tom Brenneman was actually a Cubs announcer, but he was during the playoffs, he'd come back to do nightly sports reports on television in Cincinnati. And he was in Lou Piniella's office right before, a day or two before the World Series, when the Reds were getting ready to play the Oakland Athletics. And Piniella, as the story goes, pointed at the advanced scouting report from Jimmy Stewart, who had put together the whole package on the A's and what, you know, strengths, weaknesses, how to pitch guys, things like that. And Stewart basically told Piniella, and Piniella told Brenneman, you guys are going to kick the A's whatever. said, you all match up very, very well with this team. And this was supposedly right before the World Series. Jimmy Stewart predicted that the Reds were just going to blow the Athletics out of the water based upon their particular strengths and the Reds' particular strengths, mostly power arms, I think, that could counter those big bashers for Oakland. So that's my Jimmy Stewart story, such as it is.
Oh, I thought you were going to do a Jimmy Stewart impression, you know.
Oh, man, that would be even worse. But you're welcome to try that if you'd like.
I know. But the other thing is, looking at two things I like about this, looking at this. One is you're looking at the guys that are going to be the basis of the trade that turns this team into the Big Red Machine. You see these guys on here. Lee Mays on this team. Tommy Helms is on this team. Jimmy Stewart's on this team. The other thing I like looking at when you look at these rosters is you see names on here that you don't even remember hearing. And the other one is there's a guy that played for this team, and he only played in three games. Well, he only batted in three games. Wait a minute. He pitched in three games. The world famous Bo Belinsky was on this team.
Bo Belinsky, the immortal.
Do you know who Bo Belinsky is?
I have no idea who Bo Belinsky is.
He threw the first no-hitter for the California Angels.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He was a famous Hollywood guy when he plays for the Angels, and I can't remember how he ended up on the Reds. But I did not remember him being on this team. There's also a guy named John Noriega on this list. No idea. Jay Ward? No idea. You get your first glimpse of a very young, a 23-year-old Bill Plummer, who ended up being a backup catcher for the Reds for the Big Red Machine. And they must have at least, I'm assuming some of this was September call-ups, with probably like Bill Plummer, because Pat Corrales was the backup catcher for bench.
I think you're making up some of these names.
But the funny thing about Pat Corrales was, and again, I'm dipping back into my brain here, he was one, you know, and you used to hear this a lot about guys that were playing behind great players, and these guys would all say, well, he's playing behind bench. If he played on another team, he'd start, you know, anywhere else. And they traded him, and he didn't start anywhere else.
Right. He did become, I think he won the World Series as manager of the Phillies, though, I believe. Wasn't he their manager when they won in 83, maybe?
Wasn't he?
I think he might have been. He was their manager. I think it was when they won the World Series. Maybe not.
But the other thing, two things that I want to talk about here, and as I was looking at the, like, when the Reds beat the Pirates in the NL playoffs, they beat them 3-0, but every game was close. And in the third game, in the ninth inning, the Pirates pinch ran for Roberto Clemente.
Wow.
That jumped right out at me.
Which game? The third game?
The third game in the ninth inning.
So that was Clemente's last game ever.
No, that was 72.
Oh, was it? I thought it was 70. I thought, okay.
That was 72, I think. I think when Bench hit that home run over his head in game five.
Oh, you're right. You're right. You're right.
And as you said in the World Series, Brooks Robinson was just unconscious. I mean, anything that was within 3 miles of third base, he caught, no matter how hard it was hit. I mean, Bench and May and Perez were hitting rockets all series, and he just caught everything.
Yeah. You know, obviously, I didn't see the series, but growing up, the highlights of that series, always you could tell when Bench would come up, hit a rocket, and Brooks Robinson would make some kind of crazy play. That series probably did more to make Brooks Robinson's reputation than anything else. Because
it sure didn't hurt him getting into the Hall of Fame.
It sure didn't. No, I mean, because here we are 30 years later. Good. I think I said 30 years later. It's 40 years later.
Yep.
Goodness gracious. Almost,
and almost 50 years later.
Oh my goodness!
You gotta remember that this is where I think the Reds started realizing they moved into a new ballpark, which was going to change their style of play. And they went into the World Series. They got beat by a team that had some really good pitching, and they realized that they were going to have to strengthen their pitching staff. And I think they went out and got Billingham in 72. You know, the 71's kind of a lost year. For a lot of reasons, and we could talk about those some other time. The injury of Bobby Tolan in 71, I think, really took a lot of, and Bench had a terrible year, I think, if I remember right. But
you look just quickly, you're right about that pitching, the Orioles pitching. Jim Palmer, Mike Cuellar, Dave McNally. Yeah, 3 20-game winners.
I don't remember who the fourth starter was. And a couple of years later, sometime in the 70s, they had 4 20-game winners.
Yeah.
I think Pat Dobson was the other one at that time.
The Immortal.
Yeah. You know, and then, you know, of course, you know, they win the World Series in 70, and then the Oakland A's take over. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 72 series. The 72 series, I did not sleep all night that night when we lost Game 7. And I have never forgiven Bobby Tolan 50 years later or whatever it is.
But, you know, I think about 70, 72, 73.
73, they just ran into a buzzsaw in the Mets pitching staff.
They ran
into Seaver, Kuzman, and Matlack. They beat Seaver in Game 1, but that was, and they only beat him 2-1 on home runs by Rose and Bench.
But you think about how much greater the legend of the Big Red Machine could have easily been. I mean, and even, you know, 77, 78, 79, they were right there.
In the 72 series, they should have won. Yeah. 73, like I said, in the playoffs, they had no right to lose to the Mets in the playoffs. But, you know, you run into, as we've found over the, you know, we've talked about this a million times, you run into a good pitching staff in a short series, it's tough. You know, anything can happen.
Absolutely. So, but that 1970 team was a fun team, and that was a team that really sort of caused you, you were already in love with the Reds, but that really caused you to fall deeply in love with them.
Oh, absolutely. And that's, you know, and when they moved from Crosley to the Riverfront, and I think that's when Haslam started seeing that they're going to have to play faster, that, you know, they're going to have to get faster on defense. So a couple years later, you got Joe Morgan playing second base instead of Tommy Helms. You got David Concepcion maturing at shortstop.
Geronimo
playing center field, who I think is the best center fielder I've ever seen play for the Reds.
Other than Billy Hamilton.
Billy couldn't hold Cesar Geronimo's tomahawk.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to name this the Billy Hamilton podcast just for that.
Here's what I'll say in comparing the two. Billy Hamilton does not have anywhere near the arm that Cesar Geronimo had.
I won't argue with that.
But, you know, you're starting to see, and it'd be interesting, and I didn't do this, and probably should have, look at the changes to the roster from 70 to 71 and see, you know, what they started to do, because we all know what happened between 71 and 72. But, you know, you wonder how good this team could have been if Maloney hadn't gotten hurt early, you know, and then you don't have a Tony Kloninger in the starting rotation. Even though down the stretch, from what I remember off the top of my head, and I didn't look this up in the schedule and results, but I remember Kloninger getting a lot of starts and a lot of them on short rest late in the season because guys were so beat up.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking here at the wins above replacement for that team, and you know, Don Gullett, 19-year-old relief pitcher, 2.5 wins above replacement.
Yeah, and Sparky kind of hit him. I mean, he didn't really let him. He kind of held him back.
Gary Nolan, almost 5 wins above replacement. I mean, that's crazy good.
I'm looking at Tony Kloninger here, and through the end of July, he had 17 appearances. He had 7 in August, and he had 6 in September. So he had 13 in the last 2 months of the season. So he was shooting, he pitched, and they got these days of rest. He pitched twice on no days of rest, one time on 2 days of rest, 6 times on 3 days of rest. So by the end of the year, their pitching staff, from what my memory reminds me, was pretty banged up.
They were
leaning on Tony Kloninger and Jim McLaughlin a lot late in the season, because Simpson didn't pitch hardly at all in the second half.
Boy, they could have used. Could have used Maloney, no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and late in the year, you know, they brought Milt Wilcox, who gave him some good innings. Now, it was only 5 games. They gave him 22 innings, but I remember him being pretty good in the playoffs. And I don't remember if it was the 70 playoffs I'm remembering or whether it was later than – it might have been 72.
I'm looking at Lee May at age 27. This will be my last comment on the 70 Reds. With an Adam Duvall special season, 34 home runs. But only 12th on the team in wins above replacement at 1.9, thanks mostly to an on-base percentage of .297.
Except that's not Adam Dunlap. Not the base percentage.
Adam Duvall. If I said Adam Dunn, I meant to say Adam Duvall. Yeah. No, Adam Duvall is what I meant.
You may have said that. I may have. Well, I heard Adam, and I immediately went to
whenever I say the word Adam, usually Dunn is the next word. But even that 34 home runs from May, only third on the team in home runs because Bench had 45 and Perez had 40. Yeah.
I mean, they had three guys with OPSs over 900.
Bench, 22 years old, 35 doubles, 45 homers, 148 RBIs. Goodness gracious, what a year.
I think that, what is that? Is that like second on the team all time in RBIs, I think?
I'm not even sure. I'm not sure about that one.
I think it's something like that. I can't remember where to look up that up real quick.
I think Adam Dunn had 214 RBIs. I'm thinking about strikeouts.
You know, the number of things that this team could do offensively, and like you said, and they were young. I mean, the oldest guy that's listed here as a starter is Helms and Rose at 29.
Right, and Helms would be gone.
In 2 years, yeah. Replaced by, I would assume, I think Joe was a little younger than Helms. I'm not sure about that without looking.
Yeah.
The oldest guy on the team were Stewart and Klein. And they weren't around much longer. The pitching staff was really young. Ray Washburn was one of the relief pitchers. He was 32. But it was a fun team to watch. I mean, they used to just beat people's brains in. I mean, you know. And as, like I said, as the season went along, the pitching staff struggled. And so the offense became more important later in the year. They only had 1 month below 500. They went 14-15 in August. They were 16-6 in April, 20-8 in May, 16-8 in June, 20-12 in July. Then they took their foot off the gas and went 14-15 in August. Then they finished September 15-11. They beat the Dodgers 13 out of 18 games. They beat Houston 15 out of 18 games.
Wow. Especially with the Dodgers, because the Dodgers would end up becoming be such a rivalry.
Well, and Atlanta, who'd won the division the year before, they beat them 13 out of 18. They basically, other than San Diego, they split with the Giants, who were in their division at the time, and they played less than 500 ball against the cellar dweller Padres, who they went 8-10 against. But against the top teams in the division, Houston and the Dodgers and the Giants. They played 500 ball or much better in Atlanta. I mean, the three, Houston and the Dodgers in Atlanta, they beat up on.
Yeah, that was some kind of team. Unbelievable to look back at them. And actually, you've told me a number of things that I didn't even realize about this. And I can see why you fell in love with them and why the National League must have been just terrified of what this young team was going to accomplish the next few years.
They also went from 12th in attendance in 69 to 2nd in attendance in 70 in the National League.
That's what winning will do for you, right?
Yeah.
And a new stadium.
You win and they'll cut. Yeah, well, that's the other thing. They went from I don't remember what Crosley was. I'd say it was probably 25 or 28,000 to 55,000 at Riverfront. The other thing, I'm looking at the game-by-game results right now. The interesting thing is to look at the times of the games. See, the first?
During the day?
Well, no. I mean the time, the game time, how long the game took.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It wasn't until April the 16th that they had a game that took over 3 hours. I mean, I'm seeing, you know, 1 hour and 58. Wayne Simpson against Don Sutton. Reds beat the Dodgers 3-0 on April the 9th, and it was an hour and 58 minutes.
You would you'll never again see a game that short.
Another Wayne Simpson game on April the 24th where he got beat 3-1 was an hour and 59 minutes. I mean, there's some of them that are 2 hours and 7 minutes, hour 57, another Wayne Simpson game. He must have worked fast.
He must have.
He beat the Cardinals 5-1 in a game that took an hour and 57 minutes.
Wow. It's sort of like I always think of Tom Browning, get the ball and throw it.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. Heck, they didn't even got the time to get the beer cold in the vending. There's another Wayne Simpson game on July the 5th at an hour and 53 minutes. They won 3-1.
Wow.
Gary Nolan game, an hour and 57. Here's one where Jim Merritt threw. They won in 5-0, an hour and 46 minutes. That's amazing.
It really is. It really is crazy. You'll never see that. I'm going
to. That's why they could, you know, that, and that's why that back then they could start at 8:05 or 8:15.
Right.
Because kids could still get home and get to bed on time. You wouldn't have kids getting home at midnight. Well, that's why, you know, what I hate those Sunday night games. Because they don't start till like 8:30, I don't think.
Yeah.
Here's a four. Now, here's a four-hour game. Of course, it was 15 innings. I mean, the 3-hour games are so rare, they jump out. I mean, there was a 3-hour and 33-minute game on April the 18th. I mean, it's just amazing to me how fast the game was played then.
Well, no, you know, television commercials. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
And of course, not as much of the preening and stepping out of the box and all that as well because the camera.
How about back to back games on July 5th and 6th of 1 minute, 1:53, 3 in a row, 1:53, 1:46, and 1:57, 3 games in a row.
Wow!
Of course, it helps when your pitchers only give up 1 run in 3 games.
Yeah, that helps the games to move a little bit quickly. Definitely so. Any final thoughts about that 1970 team, Bill?
I wish they'd won the World Series.
Well, there's nothing I can do about that one, but certainly I think one of the best teams, regardless of whether they won the World Series, one of the best teams in Reds history, and a good one to start off with our team retrospective.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got the building blocks of the Big Red Machine, and yet enough you see enough of the weaknesses to understand why they made the moves they made.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a fun team to look at. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for us here on Red Leg Nation Radio. Any final thoughts about anything we've talked about today, Bill?
Billy Hamilton has to learn how to hit.
Oh, come on. Billy Hamilton is a superstar. He's a comic book superhero.
Without the cape.
I'm telling you, Bill, I'm going to have to work on you next time. thank you all for listening to Red Leg Nation Radio, episode number 138. The title will be something once I decide on it, with something cleverly including Billy Hamilton. As you know, you can subscribe on iTunes. We also, the RSS feed will be up at redlegnation.com, where if you use whatever your podcast device is, you can subscribe. Yeah, if you do subscribe via iTunes, or even if you don't, go to iTunes and give us a rating and a review if you could. As we always say, if you like us, tell people about us. You know, the audience has really grown here the last few weeks, and I'd like to keep that momentum up. If you like us, tell people about us. If you don't like us, keep your mouth shut. You can read us at redlegnation.com every day on Twitter at redlegnation. Bill, you've not been on Twitter much lately. We're going to have to get you back on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm keeping a low profile.
At Bill Redleg N. I'm at Dotson C, D-O-T-S-O-N-C, on Twitter. And redlegnationradio.com is where you can find all past episodes of the program. Bill, as always, it's been a blast, buddy.
Love doing it, man.
Well, we'll do it again very soon then. For Bill Lack, this is Chad Dotson saying so long, everyone.